the Time on Radio Lounge. I'm Sonic. I'm here with Swarmy. Well,
namaste.
And we have the pleasure of welcoming back Ollie Damagard. How are you today, Ollie?
I'm absolutely blessed, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. So, where should we start?
Kindly allow this one to just start out saying, once upon a time, not that long ago, Ollie wrote to this Swami over Skype and said he had some, I believe the quote would be, mind-blowing information regarding Anders Breivik and the Norway shootings. Ollie?
Sounds pretty good. I've just returned from Norway. I went up there just before the anniversary. It all happened on the 22nd of July 2011, and I went up there just before the anniversary to be there. I always try to be on location to get an emotional connection with the victims, and also to get a better feeling for distances, angles, and so on when I look into these cases. And this one, I had absolutely no idea about the magnitude of it. It's an extremely sensitive area. I mean, I've been warned several times about talking about this in Norway and so on. I'm just leaving in a week again back to Norway. I'm going to do two talks about this very thing in Oslo. And I was almost arrested by a police that always was a member of the Delta team. And when we go through this whole thing, you will hear that the Delta team is very, very central in the whole carrying out of this operation. So if it would be okay with you, I would like to just first go through the official story, and then I would like to say what I believe is more closer to the real truth. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
The floor is yours.
The floor is mine. Okay. On the 22nd of July, this is the official story. It is said that a Norwegian guy, a 32-year-old man by the name of Anders Behring Breivik, that he was very upset for different reasons, and multiculturalism, and also he thought that the Norwegian Labour Party had betrayed Norway. So what he decided to do was to go with a fertilizer bomb. I mean, it's almost identical to the Oklahoma City scenario, where he had a rental van and a fertilizer bomb that he had constructed himself, 950 kilos in the back of the van. And he drove and parked it right behind the government building where they received deliveries and whatever. And he then left the car. He was dressed in a police uniform with a helmet and a plastic shield in front of the face, so you cannot see who actually left the vehicle. He then walks away with a pistol in his hand. There's several photos taken of him by surveillance cameras, and he just walks away with no one stopping him, no one doing anything. Then he gets to a second van, a smaller van, and leaves the area. And then he detonates the bomb with a remote control. The bomb absolutely blows up the whole neighborhood around the government building. I mean, if listeners are interested, please go to Google Images and search for Oslo bombings. So then you can see for yourself. The whole area is just totally blown up. And then it's said that he took this other van, the small van, drove about 40 minutes northwest of Oslo to a small island called Utøya, which is out in, it's a beautiful area with a big fjord and this island. It's very close to the mainland. It's so only like 600 yards from the mainland. It's a heart-shaped island, and it's an island that has been used by what is called AUF, the youth movement of the youth party of the Labour Party in Norway. And there were more than 500 teenagers there and some adults as well. There was a summer camp. And it is then said that Anders Breivik parked the car where there's a small little ferry boat going across where it can only take one vehicle. He was still dressed like a police officer. He went under the name of Martin Nielsen, and he then entered this little ferry and went to the island. On the island, he was met by a woman who was in charge of this whole thing, plus a security guard, which just happened to be the stepbrother of the Norwegian princess. They had a short discussion, and suddenly he just pulls out a pistol and a rifle, exactly the same type of weapons that Timothy McVeigh is said to have used in Oklahoma City. It was a Ruger Mini 17 and a Glock 17 as well. So he, with no warning, he just pulls it out and kills these two people, boom, boom, execution style. People, teenagers around them freaks out when this happens, so they start panicking and runs and hides in all different areas of the island. But during 1 hour, more than 1 hour, he just walks very calmly around and kill people uninterrupted. No one is trying to stop him, nobody is trying to come to the rescue, and he is allowed for more than 1 hour to walk around and totally slaughter 69 people on this island until the so-called Delta team finally arrives to the island after more than 1 hour and invades the island, calls him up and makes him surrender. He is now put in prison for more than 20 years, and it's the official story, nothing else. This is what is true, what I've just told you. If you ask media, if you ask the government, if you ask any journalist in Norway, as far as I know, I'm only one of two or three people who have seriously looked into this. So, is this the real truth, or could there be another variation of the whole thing? There was a man that I really, really admired. His name was Fletcher Prouty. He was way up in the Pentagon and way up in the CIA, and he was the man in the JFK movie that is called Mr. X. He was played by Donald Sutherland. And he spent his whole life after the JFK assassination, when he suddenly understood the evil that he was involved in, he put himself on the front line and spent the whole rest of his life exposing so-called false flag operations or black op operations. And one of the things he said, when there is a black operation going on, one of the sure ways to see it is not from what is carried out, but what does not work, what is not functioning, and so on. Because when these black ops are executed, they need to control all parameters. And what they do is they shut down all type of security systems, they get the bodyguards out of the way, they shut down surveillance cameras, they block radio channels, they block media's way of reporting and so on. The phone systems are shut down. All of the normal police activity goes into some kind of weird stand down or standby mode. So if we look at this thing, I now explain the official story. So if we look at what happened this day, then we might get a different take of the whole thing. So please understand that Norway, it's a small country. It's only, I think, there are 4 or 5 million people like that. But it's a very important part of NATO, and it's highly skilled. It's well known for its soldiers, the special troops and special ops and so on. They're very highly respected in NATO and so on. So they should be able to carry out a good job as well in a situation like this. Even though when we look at this one, I mean, officially, Norway was totally unprepared for a thing like this. So, of course, give them some slack because of the surprise and so on. But I just want to point out things here. Now, on this day, one of the things when you look at the images is that there's a total lack, more or less, of people surrounding this. This happened at 3:30 in the afternoon. It was a Friday afternoon. It was in the end of the summer holidays, in the middle of them, on the 22nd of July. And many of these black ops and top assassinations are carried out on Friday afternoons. In my humble opinion, the reason for that is because then the stock market can shut down, close, because of out of respect for the victims. And what they then do is that they close currencies, they do all types of inside trading that has been building up right up until the actual event takes place. And then they have all the way until Monday morning to cover their traces and get rid of as much evidence as possible, and at the same time make absolute billions. Because if you know about a thing like this, you can make incredible fortunes.
Oh, right.
When, for instance, when Kennedy was killed, when the Swedish Prime Minister was killed, normal people think that, oh my God, this is a tragedy. But if you know it beforehand, like the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, it was then almost the all-time high of the stock market in Sweden.
Really?
The stock exchange. So this is, not only do they get rid of an enemy or whatever it is they want to accomplish, they do a lot of inside trading, you know, where they know beforehand what is going to happen, and then they just totally use it.
Right. We had the same thing here in the U.S. with the airline.
9/11.
Yeah, on 9/11.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, this is the thing. I am not going to tell you anything new because this has been used in so many different operations. What is special with this one is that no one is looking into it. And also, this is a very dark world record in victims when it comes to the victims of a lone so-called crazy guy.
Well, so, can I ask a quick question with the...
Please do.
With the explosion in Oslo, shouldn't that area have been busy with people moving about?
Thank you, Swami. And yes, okay. That's the whole thing. This is a Friday afternoon. There should have been lots of people. It's a little bit of a back street, but it's right in the center of Oslo. Mm-hmm. The government building itself is 15 floors high. And it's surrounded by buildings, the energy department, the oil department, there's a fire station, there's a courthouse, there's, you know, lots of activity going on normally. But this time, it is like there's hardly any victims. And why? Because the buildings were more or less evacuated. There were no one there. There were a few, and this is also standard, because when people carry out, or these dark forces carry out black ops, they need real victims. Nowadays, it's sometimes it's staged event with crisis actors, but sometimes also they carry these things out where they mix a mixture of real victims to get the numbers up, the credibility up of that it really was a terror event.
It's like a live drill.
It is a live drill, yeah, exactly. And here we had there was a live drill ongoing today, and it ended 22 minutes before the actual thing went off. 22 minutes. It ended at 3 o'clock, and 22 past 3, boom, the bomb went off. Also, the night before this happened, there was people in black uniforms being observed in the area doing things that people didn't know what really was going on. So, but I would like to suggest that in this event, you had real victims, but you had also crisis actors to be totally sure that they could bombard the media globally with some really horrific images, and we're going to come back to them. Mm. Because there are some some cover girls that just went global. And these there's four or five of them that I totally will show was crisis actors. Okay, so what happened was when the bomb blew off, there's no trace whatsoever of the van, but that is normal as well. If you have a car bomb that size, it will blow more or less all of it into smithereens. The engine will be there, and other parts of the car, like tires and so on, will sometimes survive. But otherwise than that, a lot will be blown away. Here we have the same thing. It's very hard to see that there's ever been a car at all. Also, the cameras, unfortunately, didn't work at this time, so you cannot see the explosion. You can see still photos. I mean, we're only talking about the government building, which is the building in Norway that should be protected. But just like Pentagon and 9/11, suddenly all the cameras, very sorry, not working. And the one that did work were only blurred still photos. Sounds familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Also, since he left with a helmet on and this glass shield in front of his face, you would not be able to, you cannot tell if it's him or not. It also, that uniform was different to the uniform that has then been put forward as evidence after the mass shooting on the island.
Oh, really?
Anyway, so when you have an explosion, there's always an epicenter. That is where the explosives are, and then everything is thrown out in all different directions equally forcefully. But then if there is a wall or a building in front of that, that will, of course, stop the damages behind that building and so on, so that you can see, you can track down and see exactly where the explosion came from and so on. Here we have a totally different picture. The whole front of this 15-story high building, all of the windows are blown out, except for four or five, which were bulletproof, where the Justice Minister had his office. Loads of windows in central Oslo were blown out as well. But when you have an explosion, a normal one, it will push in the window so that the glass will be found inside the buildings. Here we have a totally different pattern. All the glass have been sucked out and is found out in the middle of the street. Also, there's not one whole window that is not crushed on this whole building and many others. Also, behind the government building, where there's other buildings that should have been sort of covered and protected from the explosion, they are just as damaged. And you can see from the few images that is actually available, you can see that there is an explosion, and then the explosion moves, but inside the building, and blows out the windows.
Oh.
Also, the sound is very, very strange here, because the people who were right in the center, some of them did not hear anything. They just, boom, the glass came. And they said that it felt like the buildings were lifted up and shaken, but there was no sound, nothing at all. And it has been filmed by some people that suddenly you just hear glass fall to the street, and then you see smoke coming up in the horizon behind some of the buildings. But there's no impact, no explosion, had it been C4 or TNT or a fertilizer bomb, which it is said to have. Nothing. On the contrary, out in the outskirts of Oslo, many people say that they heard what was like, it sounded like a thunder storm sound, like a drawn out thunder.
So what do you think created that?
I'm coming to that, because also where the debris from the building, there's nothing. Like normally you have like a crater if there's a car bomb, like you will have a crater underneath, and then things will have just been blown away from that area. But here everything is spread very evenly all over the place. There's nothing that shows that a bomb has gone off. There's just debris all over the place. And then in the beginning, when people came running there, there were absolutely no one there, just a lot of smoke and so on. But sorry, I lost the thread. But anyway, so there's also one guy that comes running there. He's filming while he's running around, shouting, "Is there anyone here? Is there anyone here? Is anyone hurt?" And he also then runs into the building. He runs like four or five stories together with a friend. They're filming it. There's no one in there. Absolutely no one. And when you look at it on many of the images, if you really go into detail, you will see that the street is shut off in one end from so-called road work. And in the other end, also there are different blockages. There's also one thing that that is standard when it comes to these things are road work or scaffolding, you know, or buildings, repair of buildings with these plastic covers. Because what do they use them for? That is where people are hiding. That is where vehicles are hiding. All of these type of things while they do it and so on. So in this case, you have the whole long street on the back of the government building is covered with this white plastic, like 2 meter high. That's like 6-8 foot high. And also after the explosion, the plastic, it's totally intact. There's no that should have been blown to, you know, totally right, torn right. apart. Nothing. That is still totally the way it should be. And above where the vehicle is said to have been parked, the ceiling, instead of being blown up, it is melted. The one side of the ceiling or roof is hanging down like melted cheese. You will also see that the damages on this 15-story high building is, it looks like something has been burning two lines down the side. And the damages to the buildings or surrounding this whole thing is the most at the top of the building, not closest to where the explosives were. So you see here, we have a major problem to explain. And I would very much like to suggest that we're looking at a similar type of weaponry used as in 9/11, where I would suggest that multiple technologies were used to make absolute sure that these buildings came down. But for sure, there was some kind of direct energy weapon, or I don't know what type of high technology weapon used at 9/11 that totally dustified these buildings. Mm-hmm. You can see that they were turned into dust. The only thing that survived these buildings were dust, aluminum, glass, and rubber, and paper. You know, So what did they use? I am not sure, but I really believe that something similar was used here.
And you were saying before about people far away on the outskirts of Oslo were reporting hearing some sort of thunder. Yeah. So would you then, if there's some sort of storm, would that create like a static field? Wouldn't it?
It's when you see there's behind this white plastic, there's a long like a ditch that has been dug along the whole street. And I've spoken to some experts, and what they claim is that when you use some of these direct energy weapons, sometimes you need to create like a static field, just like you're saying, like a magnetic field around the target to amplify the effect. I'm not totally sure how that works, but they say that by having like an electric wiring around the target area, that is how you accomplish it. And right after the bomb went off, or whatever it was that went off, there was a TV crew that came running to try and film it. And they were pushed away by at least three military police, Norwegian military police, young soldiers that were telling them to back off. At the same time, they were very intensely trying to pull together a long, long white cable of some sort. Whatever that cable were, they came in two white vans, these three soldiers. They have never been identified. even though there was an article saying we were the ones doing it, but they were not the same soldiers. And also there are things with the uniform that doesn't match up with the official uniforms. So they were sort of rolling up this white cable with blue gloves and rolling it up. And I believe that there is a chance that this cable were part of surrounding the target area, and that the rest was dug down in this long ditch behind this white plastic.
So, are there any more similarities? Have you looked into the seismic data of that blast to see whether or not it was actually felt in the earth?
It is a very good question, Sonic, because I looked into it and there were data, but that website has gone down. As far as I know, it's not available anymore. And that's the National Seismological Institute. I cannot get their website from that day to work. But what some people said, that there were double explosions. They had two explosions. And I think that it is possible that they had a car bomb and this type of whatever it was, high-tech weapon from above, so that the car bomb went off, making damages to, there's another vehicle that stood like 15 meters from the van, and that one, the impact on that car is exactly what would be identical to what it would look like had it been hit by a bomb, because they've done other test explosions with the same vehicles and so on, where you can see the impact is identical. So I think maybe they have done that to try and get around investigators like myself to find out what actually happened, so that they blow up a car at the same time hitting the buildings with this high tech. I don't know. I'm not totally sure about that yet, but that is a theory. Or otherwise, they've just transported that blown up car and just dumped it on the pavement beforehand. I'm not sure. Anyway, there are other unidentified soldiers in brown camouflage uniforms. There are three of them together with another guy. All four of them are carrying identical black cases. What these are, no idea. But I've been able to spot them in four different positions around the site after the explosion happened. And also these three military police, they are then afterwards part of taking care of the people that I claim are crisis actors. I'm going to come to them soon. So I've got good images of these guys and so on. Identifiable photos, facial photos of them and so on. I'm not saying that they were the ones guilty of this whole thing. I'm saying they were part of the operation. Right. This is we'll come to it. It is a massive black op, if I'm correct. Absolutely massive. Anyway, so on the back of the site where the so-called bomb went off, there are people that I believe were killed. There was one woman that was killed by the blast and so on. There was officially said that there were 8 people killed this day. I put a question mark around some of them, but I do believe some of them were actually killed there. But on the other side of the so-called front of the government building, where you will see more or less no images compared to the images that is out on the internet and in newspapers from the back of the building where most of the devastation is, that is where suddenly these crisis actors appears. And when you see them, they're all connected to the Justice Department in Norway. There's 4 of them, and one of them is a woman. Her name is Lina Nersnes, and she has like a 30 centimeters, that's like a foot long, rod sticking right out of her head, a wooden thing that they say that she was hit by this when the explosion took off. She's walking around. Yes, she looks like she's in pain. But she is together with another woman who her whole face is covered in blood. I mean, we're not talking just a pint or two. It is totally covered. And her whole front of her dress and everything is covered in blood. but there's no blood at all in her hair, neither the other ones. Absolutely not a drop. And they are walking around up and down in front of these photographers and film cameras as well. A long time after this happened, the smoke has gone, all of that has gone, but they're still there being walked or being sat in front of the cameras. And then what then happened is, like, in the background of these photos, you will see that there are ambulances, but they're not taking into the ambulance. I mean, if I had like a 30 centimeter wooden thing sticking out of my head, I would be somewhat concerned. You know? But here, they're just sitting there, all walking around. And then there is one medic that comes forward, and he comes up to this woman who's totally covered in blood, and asks if he can take her pulse, check her pulse. She's not holding her hands to cover any of the cuts or stop the bleeding or anything like that. On the contrary, I managed to find a video that was taken that. And you can just see them walk around, and she doesn't want to touch her face to get sort of color on her hands, and she's very aware of not getting it to her hair and so on. And then instead of them getting into the ambulance, being rushed off to hospital, I mean, 30 centimeter rod sticking out of the head might be more than just a mere headache, right. You know. Right. Then what they do is they stop a normal bus that happens to be empty, a big red bus, and they take these four or five people in the bus, and then the bus is escorted by an ambulance towards the hospital.
This is ridiculous. I mean, this is very much like the group of crisis actors photographed at the Boston Marathon bomb.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Wow.
That is how you stop normal people from interfering. You know, this is the way you control all parameters. You get them in where you can be checking everything. And then another of these four people, there's one called Anders Spildo. And this guy, he's working in the government, but I have not been able to find anything about this guy except on the government webpage, where it says that he was employed, blah, 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 blah. But here we're talking about somebody high up in the government. Wouldn't he have some kind of career or something, you know, be a successful guy somewhere along the line to have some kind of presence on the internet? The only thing I found was that there's a black and white photo from, I think, the 70s where his hair was black. It was now totally white. And he was an estate agent. That's it. I have not been able to find anything else. But he is right there in the center. And then he is also one of the people that is at the core of this whole thing. It's said that he was close to the prime minister at the crisis meeting and so on. And the other guy, exactly all of these are standing on the same corner of the street. And the other guy is his advisor. The prime minister as vice. He's a very young guy, and it's said that he had a cut in the back of his head, and then he's taken in the bus to the hospital, and then suddenly he appears in a meeting with the prime minister.
Without a wound?
I don't know. He's got a whole type of band-aid on head, but that doesn't really say a lot when it comes to these type of wounds. Also, the first guy who I described, Spildo, he has also, he's white-haired and a lot of blood on the side of the face, absolutely nothing in the hair, nothing whatsoever.
Wow.
And it said that the woman with the bloody face, she had between 60 and 70 stitches but very recently after that, she was at the trial and so on, not a mark in the face at all, as far as I can see. And the woman with the rod coming out of her head, she was out in 2 weeks, it said, from hospital and back working because she was so traumatized that she preferred going back to work. Okay, I would say rod sticking out of the head, 2 weeks, not a lot to heal, but right. There you go. So there's another, just after the explosion or whatever it was took place, people came running, normal people came running up there, and there was smoke coming out, and there was this woman who looked very official. She has a white shirt on, blue pants, a name tag, a walkie-talkie in the hand, and she's very authoritarian, just saying, back off, no filming, go away, and says, when you check out her uniform, it is like a mix of uniforms. It looks like a mix between a police civilian uniform and a fire, and a woman working in a fire station. There's no badges on the sides of the arms where they normally are. The colors doesn't match and so on. So who this woman was, big question mark. Mm-hmm. Who the soldiers were, big question marks. Who the soldiers in the camouflage uniforms were, big question mark. Okay, so unfortunately, even though the fire brigade, the fire station is right, it's sort of like only 100, 200 meters from where this whole thing happened. Unfortunately, the blast was so powerful that all carports were stuck, so they could not get out.
What?
So except
so the doors that they would drive out through were stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I got film footage by a civilian who just filmed, and when this whole thing happened, just a minute or so after, he's running around down by the fire station, which is one, it's sort of like underground. They're on different levels in Oslo, and there are fire wagons standing outside, but they're not being used. So all of these people, no one can come there to rescue. There are no ambulances. The ambulances are being directed to a different street. And also they're being told to back off because of suddenly somebody screams secondary explosives, just like they did in Oklahoma City.
Right.
Do you remember where? Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the live on CNN, saw the live as it was happening, and they came out saying there's bombs in there.
Exactly. But what happened when they did that was that they cleared the whole area from normal people who were trying to save these poor people that were lying there in the ruins, dying, being wounded, mm-hmm. and so on. All of these were called back. And instead, there were two vans that came with people dressed in blue overalls that went straight into the blown up building and came out with office furniture, these file cabinets. And put them in the van, took off right away. The files that they've picked up were the files that incriminated Bill and Hillary Clinton in the so-called White River scandal. They had just been transported from Mena, Arkansas, to the Alfred Murray building in Oklahoma City just before that, and that was going to court. So you go figure. I mean, how could these people know had they not been involved? So warning, more bombs, clear the area, go in, get rid of all the evidence, take off, and then you let people come back. At the same time, while people are lying, dying, being blown to pieces. It's so awful, these things. But here we have somebody suddenly screaming, secondary explosives, more bombs, clearing the whole area. So the fire brigade, the ambulances, everybody is called off. So it's totally empty there. And anyway, it's said that 8 people died this day in there, and that there were many were wounded and so on. Also, the official story says that thousands of people left the area, ran away just after the explosion. But when you look at the images that was taken the seconds after and minutes after, it's totally, there's empty. And just as a little curiosity type of thing is that in 2006, which is 5 years exactly before this happened, and at the same time when Anders Behring Breivik started his career sort of in a different area, there was a newscast where the reporter was interviewing a security guard from the government right outside the government building, where they were standing pointing at the exact spot where the van was going to be parked 5 years later. And they said, we have discussed this a lot, you know, there's a risk, a national security risk here, that if there was a terror attack, then this would be the exact spot where the most damage would be done from. So we need to protect ourselves from this. This was exactly 5 years before this happened. So please be aware, some of these operations have a long preparation before it actually takes off. And it can also be things that are being planned and then, if needed, being carried out. So this day, it would have been great to have a helicopter, for instance, so that they could go up, because there was a witness who saw Breivik, or whoever it was in the police uniform, get into this other car and take off. He wrote down the number because he thought it's a wee bit strange that a man in a police uniform with a helmet, with a glass shield in front of it, and a pistol in his hand jumps into a private car and takes off. So he wrote down the number, called into the police after this happened. Unfortunately, the police didn't react to this number at all, so that was put aside and nothing was done with it. But the police helicopter that could have been used were this very summer, unfortunately, to save money, the helicopter crew had been given 4 weeks extra holiday to save money, it said. But when you check out the budget for the year before, they had $22.7 million in saved funds. So why save even more?
Right, right.
Unfortunately, this day also, that the police had a special computer system for these type of alarms, but to unfortunately this day it was turned off.
Oh.
Unfortunately, there were only 4 people on duty, 4 or 5 police officers on duty in central Oslo this day, because it was summer holiday and so on. And 2 of them were stationed outside the US and the Israeli embassy. Go figure.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the police had to go out without weapons or bulletproof vest or anything like that, because unfortunately, just a few weeks before this happened, it was said that everybody was told to give in their weapons, their bulletproof vest and so on. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear the donkey?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe we should cut that out.
We'll fix that in post.
Okay. I think yeah, I'll that's
it's Rasputin, the donkey. He's doing the blues. He's recorded 3 solo albums, by the way. No, but but unfortunately, the police had to get to the area, to this terror attack area, without weapons, without anything, because just a few weeks before, they had been ordered to give in all their equipment. Why? No explanation. They just had to do that. And unfortunately, there were new rules saying that at least 2 officers needed to be on site to open the locker so that they could get their equipment. This day, there were no 2 officers, so they could not get hold of their equipment. Now, unfortunately, the special trained terror unit were not being told about this. They were not being alerted and so on. And also some of them had extra holiday. Now, unfortunately, it took some 77 minutes before there was a national alert that went out there. It's a small country, you know, it's border to Sweden. So it would have been a good day to maybe a good idea to maybe block that road if you're looking at a terror
right.
event. But unfortunately, it took 2 hours and 36 minutes before they even heard of it at the border. Okay, so you see, we have some problems here. And I would like, if it's okay with you, to go to chapter 2, which is the island.
Yep.
Okay, so while all of this was happening, I mean, it was total chaos. It is said that the prime minister, who was not in his office, like no one else this day, he was actually in what they say the prime minister's house on the behind the royal castle. And when this happened, they went down in sort of like the basement that is sort of like a bunker. And from there, he was then starting the whole process of what to do with this so-called terror event. And while this was happening, it is said that Anders Breivik took this other rental car, drove up some 40 kilometers northwest of Oslo. Unfortunately, when you check it out on Google Map, and if I've been driving there myself, the time does not match how he could get there in time.
No.
So he was very fortunate to do that anyway, because there was a major road accident that day. Road accidents also is something, when you look at Black Ops, you have to be aware of that. Sometimes they simulate road accident to block normal traffic. It's a matter of blocking all the normal roads and emergency exits and so on. I don't know about this accident. I just say this is a standard thing in many operations. And this very day, boom, we had this exact thing happening at the same time as the bomb went off. But it said that Anders Breivik, he was so good at navigating in Oslo, so he took some narrow, small streets, got out, and went off to the island. Now, the island is owned by the Labour Party in Norway. It's an absolutely stunning place, a small island with a few buildings on it and a big football, pitch. There's some where people can camp, and there's a small school building, some toilets, a pump house, a main building, and so on. Very few buildings on the island itself. Also, the only way to get to the island is with this small ferry called MS Torbjörn. It's a former Navy vessel, armored, so it's been used to take troops when they do sort of an assault on a beach or something like that. This is the type of vessel that is being used. And it is perfect, because armored, then that could be the perfect thing to help in a situation like this. It is said then that Anders Breivik came to this little ferry. It's a very small parking. Maybe you can park 30, 40 cars maximum. And the vessel itself can take either 50 people standing up or one vehicle, and then 10, 15 people and so on. So a very small boat. Anyway, he got on board. And he said that he came from the PST, which is the Norwegian Security Police. He came there because of what had happened in Oslo, and he wanted to go to the island to check security and so on. The woman in charge on the island had heard that he came, so she came and met him. They then went across together. There were other people on board as well. And they said that he had like a scuba diver top on, and then police pants. This scuba diver outfit had like a police emblem on the shoulder and so on. And he was carrying a very heavy bag. When they came to the island, the guy who the captain of this little vessel, he had a car there, so he helped him carry this heavy bag into the car, and they drove and parked it behind the main building. Then the police officer and some other people went up to the main building and started talking. What was said, I don't know. But suddenly some witnesses saw this police officer pull out a gun and kill the woman and one security guard that was working extra that day. He is the one that is actually the stepbrother of the Norwegian princess. Mm. So coincidence or not, I don't know, but one of the absolute first victim, if not the first, was the stepbrother of a royal princess. So I think that is worth to keep in mind. Anyway, after that, he just calmly pulls out these guns and start walking around killing people. And all of these teenagers just absolutely freak out and run in all different directions trying to hide. He then walks around saying, "Don't worry, I'm the police. I'm coming here to protect you." Some people came up to him and said, "Please show a identity, you know, ID and so on." And he just pulled out the gun, killed them as well. So most of these youngsters had mobile phones. This was 2011. So they started calling the police. Unfortunately, this day, the calls went to a small police station north of where this island is. And they only have two incoming lines when it comes to emergencies. So within a few minutes, there were more than 200 calls coming in. So everything was just blocked. And the few people that managed to get through was met by someone, I am not totally sure who that was, but very arrogant person who said that, "Please don't disturb us. We have an emergency in Oslo." And so on. And these teenagers were, "But we're being shot at. They're killing us here. Please, please help us." And then this person said, "I'm sorry, we do not trust you. Please call your parents and ask them to call us." So they did that. And the parents then, in total panic, started calling the police as well. And if they managed to get to the police, they were also met very coldly, very with no compassion, no nothing, is what these parents say. So at one point, though, the police answering said, "Don't worry, the police are coming, both in vehicles, in the air, and by boat." No one came. Okay, so when all of this happened, when they actually started to understand that there was an emergency going on, several different the alarm went out to different areas. But unfortunately, this day, one of the local police cars that was specially equipped for emergency situations and these type of things, I think it was armored and so on, that day, unfortunately, the battery was flat, so they needed to find jumper cables and to even get it going. Also, unfortunately, there were several different crews for police helicopters and so on, especially one in Oslo, that finally got in position, and they reported themselves, "We're available, we got a sharpshooter here, we're on our way to, we can take him out in a few minutes." They were told to stand down. A direct order, stand down. Who gave that order? I'm still trying to find out. That was a direct order, stand down. Please remember, every single minute we're talking about now with this delay, young people between the age of 14 and 17, most of them, were being shot, killed, slaughtered, blown up, and so on. It's awful, awful. Well, finally, when the first police came to the place, they didn't know how to get to the island, because just after the shooting started, the chairman of the youth party, his name is Eskil Pedersen, he and some friends came from the main building, and they said that somebody called them and said, "You gotta run down to the boat and take off." So they went, they did that, the captain was with them. And so they ran, got on board on this boat. There were nine people in total. I have not been able to identify all of them. But instead of going straight across to the mainland, which would be like 600 yards, 600 meters, they suddenly went straight north. And they went out there. And while they were out there, while the whole shooting was going on, they turned off the engine and was drifting around while Eskil Pedersen is said to have made some phone calls to the prime minister, to other top people. And then once that was done, the boat started again, the ferry started again, and went straight north. I mean, we're talking mainland is straight east, but here they go straight north for almost 3 kilometers before they ram this ferry up on shore so it cannot be used.
What?
They then say that they ran off, and they were taken by, I think, with by police to the nearest police station, where they were kept, or they were there at least, for 5 hours, more or less. And it said that, unfortunately, the police could not drive them anywhere because they didn't have the capacity to, all the vehicles were occupied. I'm going to get back to this Eskil Pedersen, because he is one key person in this whole thing. But once the first police came there, instead of using going to, there's a camping site very close called Utvika, and there were more than 20 normal boats, you know, owned by normal people. But instead of using this boat, they just took off. The police took off again. And they said that they were, because of there was an armed gunman out there, they were not, they didn't have the equipment, they didn't have bulletproof vests, and they would have been like a sitting duck for him to kill them. So they didn't go there. Okay. So anyway, when they were driving around there, there were no attempt of getting hold of a boat or anything, because while this whole thing was happening, many of these young teenagers were trying to swim away from the island, and lots of ordinary people jumped in their boats when they heard the shooting and went to try and save these right. these kids, and many of them were saved, even though the shooter killed quite a few of them in the water. He also shot at the boat, so I mean, they were real heroes, the people that did it. But no police officers were helping. Absolutely none. Okay.
And they could have commandeered. I mean, the law allows a police officer to commandeer a vehicle in an emergency, and they just.
God, yeah. But people were saying, use my boat, but no one was doing it. And this was only, there were very few police officers there to start with. Now, there's different small cities around this area, and in two of these cities, small cities, Asker and Bærum, they had free patrols, with cars,
mm-hmm.
that said, we're ready, let us do, you know, let us help. And they said, no need for you, everything is okay, don't worry. And another one from a city called Drammen, they were told, don't stop by the island, just continue north. So they passed the whole thing and went up to another island, which was north of that, like 8 kilometers, some 5-6 miles further north. Now, thank God we had the special ops. They were called the so-called Delta Team. There were 5 different of these teams this day. They were very central in the whole thing around in Oslo, and when they heard about this, of course they went straight to the island. Unfortunately, there was a problem with the communication, because they had the latest digital system and the normal police had the analog system, so they could not communicate with each other. And in the whole operation, with all of these different organizations and groups within the government, so they could not communicate with each other officially, because of these different systems being used, not being able to communicate with each other. So many of the things were done by fax. They were sending things to each other by fax and using their own mobile phones. Okay. So anyway, when the Delta Team finally arrived, they managed to miss where the ferry was. They passed that. I mean, these roads are not big. So I can understand that if you come and you're really in a hurry, that you can drive by that. We almost missed it ourselves when I was there. And then they went to this camping site just north of that. They then asked a girl that was working there, they said, where's Utøya? She pointed to that island, whereupon the Delta Team in their armored car just took off and drove north towards another island. And they went I don't know in miles, but it's like 5 miles further north, where they met up with, I think it was from a fire brigade nearby that had a rubber boat. So this Delta Team, with all this heavy equipment and bulletproof vests and weapons and helmets and whatever, they jump into this rubber boat. There are 10 of them, but they're so heavy, they stand up. This is, you can find it on YouTube, they're standing up. It looks like Monty Python had made this up. They're standing up in this rubber boat, and they take off. Of course, unfortunately, they're aiming for the wrong island, not towards where the shooting is going on, but it's an island called Storøya. So after a little while, they discover, oh, mistake. So they change the direction and go towards Utøya, the real island. But it's way, way, way far away. What happens is
I'm just looking at the map. And it'd be weird for them to actually get on a boat to Storøya, because there's a bridge that goes across to it.
They got in the rubber boat on the mainland, right where the bridge starts from that island. But if you look at that map, you will see that it's so stupid to take that. But it's perfect if you want to delay the whole thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the rubber boat is on its way, finally. The Delta team is there with all their equipment and all that. And then, unfortunately, because there are that many and that heavily equipped, it starts taking in water and the engine dies. So they are floating around. This super trained Delta team is floating around in a rubber boat that is taking in water. But thank God there's some ordinary people in their normal boats that comes up and say, what's going on? What's going on? So they swap with two of these boats. So the Delta team splits up in two groups and starts towards the island. Do they go full speed ahead? No, they go like this towards the island. Now, while this whole thing is happening, I mean, we're talking a delay of more than 1 hour. That is 60 minutes while people are being slaughtered. Kids, your kids, my kids, that are desperately they're calling their parents, say, please, please come and help us. And then suddenly there's no more calls coming, you know. Awful. Anyway, so while this is happening, people on the mainland, there are several witnesses that say that they heard shooting from different parts of the island at the same time, saying there was more than one shooter. Some witnesses on the island talks about three different shooters in police uniforms that are walking around killing people. There was a young daughter of a high-level police commissioner that was working together with the Delta team. She called her dad and said, please, please come and save us. There are four or five people in police uniforms walking around killing us, and they have also hung explosives in the trees. Now, I would say that since this is coming from the daughter of a police officer, there might be a chance that she knows what she's talking about.
Right.
But this has been totally neglected and totally not, it has not, it's not official information anymore. She's not giving interviews. And the witnesses that were on the island talking about more than one shooter, some of them have left Norway because they've been harassed and so on, or they don't feel secure there anymore. Also, there's one press helicopter, because no helicopters came while this whole thing was going on, except two black, unidentified helicopters, which is standard when you look at these black ops.
Right.
Okay, they're circling around the island, no one else, and when I've been in communication with a helicopter pilot that day, he said that they were told they were not allowed to pass that island. It is said to, because of security and so on, but please keep in mind, youngsters were being murdered, slaughtered every single minute. Anyway, so there were 11 helicopters, all of them landing on Storøya and around there. Ambulances, military helicopters and so on. But the military, who had helicopters that could come and help, unfortunately, their crews were also on holiday, and unfortunately the helicopters that were there had just been repainted, so they had to start putting back antennas and these different parts that were needed and so on. So that was delayed as well. And unfortunately, many of the people calling to the police, due to a problem in the phone system, a relay that wasn't working, that diverted the phone calls to the wrong police station. So people were calling to the wrong police station talking about this. So anyway, there was one press helicopter that was getting some footage of what was going on. And by chance, they just got some footage of the shooter while he was walking around shooting down there. Now that guy, who was partly bald, was a southpaw. He was a left-hand shooter, and the guy who is now accused for this whole thing is right-handed. Mm. Also, the uniform that he has on, that you can see from this aerial footage, is not the same uniform as witnesses are talking about and as has been put forward as evidence in the trial and so on. The reflexes are in a different position and so on. And also, when Breivik is said to have come to the island, he came like with the top of his was like a wetsuit. This guy has a full uniform on. So I would say there's a lot pointed towards multiple shooters. Right. Also, the ammunition that is being used in the autopsy protocol, it says nothing about the caliber or anything. When you go through all the victims, it just said shot three times, for instance, with rifle and or gun. Shot two with gun, shot three with rifle and gun. This type, but no caliber, no nothing like that. And the hit rate that he, the number of shots fired
right.
and the number of hits is unreal. It's sort of like 86% or something like that. And we're talking about with a semi-automatic weapon, you do not hit that much, you know, especially if people are running around and so on, way too high up. But the ammo that has been found is a very special ammunition coming from a company called Silvertip, I think it's named. And that ammo is a special ammunition that is banned for civilian use and military use because it's just so awful. Because right. when it hits, it's more or less pulverizes inside the body and accomplish incredible damage to the body tissues and organs and so on. Now, that the only ones that uses this are the CIA Special Ops and Mossad. These are the two that I know for sure are using this type of ammo. And, well, what can I say?
Yeah.
Also, when the families received the dead children, unfortunately, some of them were told that their children had drowned. But when they opened the casket, they were full of bullet holes. And the medical team said, well, sorry, we didn't notice. Also, very odd. Very odd is that for 2 days after this happened, they were talking about 86 victims. 86. It changed. It was first it was more than 90, then it was 86, and it stopped at 86. But then, unfortunately, they had miscalculated, so in the end they came down to 69, ending on 77. This number 77 is a number when you look at these black ops, sometimes there's this
can
very dark
that
and sinister.
Your audio just broke up. Yeah.
Okay. The total number of victims in the end, including the 8 from Oslo, ended on 77. Mm-hmm. And when you look at these black ops and so on, many times they have very occult ritualistic
numbers.
Areas surrounding them, and the numbers as well, the numerology, the dates, the time, and so on. And 77 is one number that keeps repeating. It was 77 minutes after the attack that the alarm went off. The victim was 77. You got loads, for instance, at the Santa Barbara shooting, 77, 711, and so on. So these numbers keep repeating. And here, the victims were first 86, then it said that no, unfortunately, they managed to count some of the bodies twice, so it went from 86 down to 69 and then up to 77. So, while this whole thing was going on, Anders Breivik was walking around shooting, killing people while he was on his mobile speaking to the police. And the one he spoke to on the police, when he called that number, it said that he called the same number that nobody else could get through. Right. But he got straight to one of the top brasses in the police organization and one that was working together with the Delta team. Okay. So he said, hello, my name is Commander Anders Spering Breivik. Mission accomplished. I am prepared to surrender to Delta team. That is what he said while he was walking around shooting. How the hell did he even know that there was such a thing as a Delta team? How did he get in touch with the guy who was actually in direct contact with the Delta team that was on its way, and so on?
Well, you know, this guy was brass. He wasn't sitting at answering phones on the, you know,
Yeah, but this day he was so helpful that he came to the police and said, please, what can I do? What can I do? Please answer the phones. So that's why he was there. But unfortunately, they couldn't call back to this number because it seems like officially that Breivik was using a phone without a SIM card. I'm not sure you can call without a SIM card, but that is what they say. That or that the mobile was locked, and because of that, they couldn't see the number. So that he called twice, and that thing, the data and everything was just put aside. They didn't see that as important, so that wasn't reported to the Delta team or anything until later. Okay, so finally the Delta team arrives, and they come to the island. They split up in two teams and start going through. They're heavily armed and so on. They go through the area. And when they see Breivik, they call out, and he, instead of that there's a shootout or resistance, he just puts down the gun, totally calm, spread out his hands, go down on his knee and then on his stomach when they come closer. Now, very oddly, when you look at the timeline, the shooting continues after he was arrested for some 5 to 7 minutes, go figure. Now, it's pretty amazing that you can do that after you're being arrested. I think that's very skillful. And also, after he was arrested, suddenly his Facebook page was updated with a 1,516 pages long manifest that is about the whole shebang about multiculturalism and the threat of Muslims and so on. But when you compare that to, what's the name of this? The Unabomber.
Right.
It's a copy and paste thing. It is the identical wording of the Unabomber, just with a few words here and there changed to fit the whole thing. In English, of course, which is always standard at these operations also, but it's never in the local language. It is prepared on Twitter and Facebook in English so that as many people as possible can get access to it and understand and so on. So I think that's pretty amazing as well, to be able to update your Facebook page after you have been arrested.
Right, while you're in handcuffs. Yeah. That's kind of hard to do.
No, but this guy is good. I mean, this is he's a slick guy. Anyway, so when he's arrested, they take photos of him. Now, when you compare the facial structure of the guy that they've taken photos of with Anders Breivik, when he's sitting being arrested in the main building, I tell you, they look similar, not the same guy. And the guy who was taking photos of right after the arrest, he has like a blue wet suit on with a police emblem on his left shoulder. He's more muscular than Breivik, more heavy set. His neck is a lot thicker. And the wetsuit of Anders Breivik is dark gray, not blue. And also on Breivik, on the chest, there's a big logo, diver logo type of thing. But the other guy who was arrested did not have that.
Wow.
Okay, so do you think maybe possibly that the official story could not be true by this time?
Oh, absolutely.
Just get a small hint.
I think that's standard practice now, though, isn't it? that the official version of events is always the most ludicrous.
Anyway, so at the same time, while all of this was happening, the Home Guard was called to Oslo and other military units But unfortunately, the home guard were not prepared for this. So when they finally came in, unfortunately, they didn't have any ammo. So one car was sent off. It took them, I think, 1 or 2 hours to go to the place where they had ammunition. And then they were denied because they didn't have the proper, paper signed and so on. But anyway, they went back without ammo. And at the same time, the radio equipment was delivered to these people who were placed around in Oslo to secure the whole thing. But unfortunately, the batteries for the radios were not charged, so they couldn't speak to each other. Anyway, so also the defense anti-terror unit or helicopter unit were warned about an upcoming terror event 40 minutes before the shooting started. But they were, and even though they went to their job saying, we're here, please let us help, they were told there's no need for you. So, also, what shall I say? Well, they didn't call him back, they didn't this. And also when the ambulances started arriving to the island, because or to the mainland, because many of these youngsters were brought, you know, they were hurt and wounded and cold and so on. They were taken care of by normal people at the camping and so on. They were doing everything they could to save them. But the first police that were there at the ferry and other places, when the ambulances arrived, the ambulance crew were not allowed to go down and help the people wounded. They were told to stand back. And not go anywhere close. It is said because they were afraid that they would be shot at. But I mean, come on, these are people that are used to be, you know, if there's an accident or a gas explosion or whatever, they're doing their duty to save lives. But here, the police told him, stand back, stand back. So, also, what happened after this whole thing was that when he was arrested, he was taken into the main building and he was kept there for a long, long time, all the way till, I think, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, at least a couple of hours after this whole thing, he was kept arrested there. And while this happened, there were some helicopters, it said, that came there and took a sharpshooter and went around the island to check if there were more shooters. But I would very much suggest that there's a very good possibility that this helicopter that was seen to pick up sharpshooters maybe picked up the other shooters and took off. That's a theory, but it's a possibility. Also, while this whole thing was going on, there was a sharpshooter that came voluntarily, and he was on the mainland. He had the whoever was shooting in the police uniform, he had him on the side, you know, in the side, in the crosshair, and could have taken him out. He had an earpiece, and he was in direct contact with the police commander headquarters. He was told, stand down, do not interfere. Okay, so what are we looking at here? There are, when you look at these type of operations on that level, very often they are surrounded by Bilderberg, members from the Bilderberg group. Are your audience aware of the Bilderberg group, Sonic?
Yeah.
Have you been?
Yeah.
Okay. It is, for those who don't know about it, it is like a part of a world shadow government. Handpicked people in key positions from more or less all Western countries. So with the idea that with a handful of people, but in key positions, if you can control them, then you can control that country more or less without the population knowing what's going on. And these people are always from the top of the society. We're talking everything from businessmen, bankers, royalties, people in communication, news, the legal system, politicians, very many politicians.
It's like Eyes Wide Shut.
And so on. It really is, but they have meetings every single year in secret locations. Now, after more than 50 years, 60 years, I think, that the Bilderberg Group has been active. Now it's they're out in the open. They can't hide anymore, and so now it's they're really doing everything they can show how kind and nice and you know, like Santa Claus type of feeling, that are just meeting to discuss golf and have a biscuit.
Do you think that now because it's so it's out there and a lot more people know about this group of people that meet up, do you think that the actual steering committees are done pre or post, and this meeting has now is just for the like a media thing, because you know all these all the groups that come in and a party to the Bilderberg Group are also part of groups that people may not have heard of, you know, like the Club of Rome and the Committee of 300 and the Rhodes Milner Roundtable and people like this. Do you think that that's now it's gone because of the internet and the way that technology has fueled information, that they've almost gone back to the roots, and there's a lot more smaller steering committees that meet up at maybe a Bilderberg group?
No, there's still the same amount. I was one of the speakers outside the Bilderberg meeting 2014 in Copenhagen, and I humbly believe that I diffused a planned false flag massacre there. But the thing is, the more exposed they've been, the more people know about them, the harder it is for them. And they used to be very arrogant and very nonchalant in their way of behaving. You know, they were walking openly when they were meeting, even though they knew that there was photographers in distance taking photos and so on. But this last meeting in Austria, Switzerland, they were running to the airport. They were hiding, more or less. They were, so the thing is that there's a big momentum going here, and they are having major problems because they have only been able to do this because they've been hiding in the dark. Right. They have been very cowardly hiding and manipulating us without us knowing it. But now we're putting the spotlight right on them, and in a totally non-violent way, but totally fearless way as well, just exposing it, saying, enough is enough. We see you. And it's time to stop this crap. We've had enough. It's not on anymore.
Ollie, kindly allow this, Swami. I got to take off. Shakima has a medical procedure we have to go and take care of. Could you say in the next 6 minutes or so what you would perceive the objective of this operation was? You know, like with 9/11, it justified going into Iraq and Afghanistan. And what was the purpose?
I can say it right away. What I believe was the reason for this. There was, when they carry out these really big operations, there's always more than one reason. But one of the main ones was that Norway was about to pull out from the bombings of Libya and Afghanistan. They had gone out openly and said, we do not back this. It is absolutely immoral to do this, and we want out. So they were planning to pull out on August the 1st, which was just a week after this happened. Also, they were also in the process of accepting Palestine as a nation and so on. So just as Obama so eloquently put it, from time to time, we need to squeeze the arms of some nations, twist the arm of some nations. And I believe this was a twist of arm of Norway. Because what also happened was, from their position of wanting to pull out, just after this happened, they went straight back in line, continued, and even were part of upgrading the bombings of these places, and became honorary member of NATO.
Mm.
And the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, who I'm going to describe now and his involvement in the whole thing, he was then, after he ended his work as Prime Minister, he was then named the next chief of NATO, which is a Bilderberg appointment. So, and when you look at the New World Order, what part of what the New World Order wants to accomplish is to have a one world army, not there to protect us, to control us. And so what they're trying is to join NATO and the UN troops. And when you hear Jens Stoltenberg, the new chief of NATO, his plan is to pull NATO apart. And I would say that is part of pulling that apart and joining with the UN troops, creating this world, one world army.
All right. So, thank you very much, gentlemen. This Swami's got to go. Ali, thank you so much for all you do and for allowing us to put your information forward. Thank you.
Can I just say to Swami Sivananda Giri, what I find is so wonderful is that nowadays it is not only about conspiracy and exposing evil, but it's becoming more and more hand in hand with spirituality and an awakening on a spiritual plane as well. So it's beautiful what this truth seeking is coming to, and I really appreciate that you are taking part of this whole thing as well.
Thank you. Namaste. Blessings all.
Namaste. Namaste.
Maybe we could have you back soon.
For sure. But Sonic, I would very much like to continue a little while more, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
Because when we look at this event, I look for Bilderbergers around it, just because they have a very strong tendency to be just before and just after, and sometimes during these operations. And here we have Jens Stoltenberg, the Prime Minister, a Bilderberger. His father, Thorvald Stoltenberg, a Bilderberger, big time player for many, many years. And also this morning, before the shooting happened, while this whole thing was being, when the drills were ongoing and so on, the former Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, came to the island and spent several hours together with these youngsters, walking around, having a good time officially with them, and then left the island. She left just a few hours before the shooting started. Now, Gro Harlem Brundtland is a very loved former prime minister, at least officially. She is also a Bilderberger high up there, and she's one of the architects, together with Maurice Strong, behind Agenda 21. And for people who are not aware of what Agenda 21 is, I would very much recommend you to look into it. There are Agenda 21 for Dummies on YouTube.
Our listeners, we go to Agenda 21 quite a lot. We have Agenda 21 watch as a little thing.
Excellent. Excellent, Sonic, because then you know also that whoever wrote that, I mean, that is a totally mad mindset if you look upon it from a normal point of view.
Yep.
And also, if that goes through, we are looking at an extremely dark and scary and controlled, fearful future. So here we have this lady who is one of the main architects behind this agenda, who comes and are there on this island. I would say that there is a ritualistic sacrifice going on as well. She's with these people that are soon to die for several hours. Then she leaves just at the same time as, or when the bomb goes off, more or less. And then she goes to Oslo, it said. At the same time, if you remember Eskil Pedersen, the leader of the youth movement, he, the guy who jumps very cowardly on the ferry, takes off and drives it and strands it on the beach. They do not even try to stop and pick up anyone that is swimming around in the air. They could have picked up at least 50 that could have lied down in this armored vessel and could have been saved. They just took off, let them die. Okay. According to some sources I have, he is the illegitimate son of Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. Jens Stoltenberg was also the leader of the youth party when he was young, as were Gro Harlem Brundtland. So we're talking like the exact, it's like a ladder following each other going the exact same route. And Eskil Pedersen, who should be looked upon as an absolute coward and also a criminal according to Norwegian law, because you are not allowed to leave somebody to drown in Norway.
No.
It's a naval nation, and it's against the law to leave someone behind. Here they left everyone behind just to save themselves. But what I would suggest, his task was to get the ferry out of, you know, so it wouldn't work.
Yep.
And stop it so nobody could interfere. And after this whole thing was, he was, there are photos of how Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg is hugging this young man. I mean, very emotional photos. He's hugging him. This, he should have been kicking his butt, saying, how on earth could you do a thing like that? Instead, he's hugging him like this. Then at the memorial in one of the main churches in Oslo, the royal family is there, Eskil is there, and there are loads and loads of people, other people, you know, high dignitaries and so on. He, Jens Stoltenberg, the Prime Minister, opens his speech with the words, Your Majesty, Eskil, and the rest of you. Do you see, he's put in a very special, like a crown prince, you know, the next prince to come. And he's had a lot of problems afterwards because people have wanted to get rid of him, but still his career is going upwards. And in 2012 or 13, there was a meeting on the island where the Danish Prime Minister, who was very central in the Copenhagen shooting and whatever followed around that, she is there on the island with Jens Stoltenberg, and in between them, Eskil Pedersen. Again, Eskil.
And also, the Prime Minister of Denmark, she's married to Neil Kinnock's son, isn't she?
I don't know.
So Neil Kinnock was the leader of the Labour Party that then went on to be like an MEP, quite big in Europe, and so is his wife, Glynis Kinnock, and their son, who's now an MP over here, he's married to the Danish Prime Minister. So there's massive conflicts of interest going around.
Yeah, if you do not look upon it from a different level, and this is the level where the Bilderberg comes in, you know, these hidden networks that is not visible for normal people.
Yeah.
But I've got a massive smoking bomb, a smoking gun in this whole thing, because I believe that the main building on that island is where this operation was controlled from. Because when you look at the victims, they were running everywhere to hide. No one was in the main building. No one was shot in the main building. No one, there was nothing. And even though the police was walking around on the island shooting, so naturally, if people would rush into that building, but no one has in. And a witness said that just before the shooting started, he went down to the building and somebody had put a note on the door saying closed on undisclosed time. I don't know how you say that in English, but on with no limitation, closed from now and forever.
Okay.
That note was there. So they couldn't get into the building. And if you had multiple shooters, where did they hide? Maybe inside the building. Why was the van parked behind the building? Do you remember when he drove up the very heavy back? Also, the number of shots fired, if it had been Breivik alone, he would not even be able to carry that amount of ammo. And on the photos, he hasn't got like ammo belts, you know, around his neck or anything like that. So I would very much suggest multiple shooters here, and also that they were supplied with ammo while doing it. And
so do you think that then they were on site or came with him?
Who, the shooters?
Yeah, the extra people, because
I think that Gro Harlem Brundtland was there to divert attention away from all of the ones on the island. She was like an icon. Everybody was listening to her in the when she was giving a talk. Everyone was there, meaning main building was left alone. That is when all of these people arrived, I would say. And the guy, the captain of the boat, was it was his wife, the first victim. But even though she was shot, he just left, and he's appeared very odd in many situations, I would say. His stories doesn't fit and so on. And then again, it's not the first time in the history of the world that a spouse has let the other one get murdered. So I would very much suggest that we have some main characters in players in this whole thing. Maybe his wife was involved with that, and they killed her to shut her up or to get rid of. Also, like the security guard who was connected to the royal family, maybe he was there to get the extra emotional amplification of the whole thing. But when the bomb had gone off in Oslo, this was way before the shooting started on the island, the national TV was trying to get hold of the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, to get a comment on what's going on and so on. And I used to make music for Swedish TV4, so I've spent a lot of time in the graphic department there and so on, so I've seen how they work exactly. And when there's a live interview going on for the news, for instance, the reporter calls into the graphic department and says, listen, I've got this guy on, please have a still photo of him. We have live footage in the background, and then I'm calling him in, let's say, Las Vegas or whatever. Then the graphic department will put in live from Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That is standard procedure. And here we have, they call up the Prime Minister. There's a still photo of the Prime Minister in the background. They're the government building with all the smoke coming and all of this. And they interview him and they said, so what do you think? What's going on? And the Prime Minister says, I have absolutely no idea, but we can't be sure if it's a terror attack and so on, but our hearts reaches out for the families of the victims and so on. Please stay calm. While he's talking, up in the left corner, it says, live from Utøya. That was before the shooting started.
Whoa!
Whoa, whoa, whoa. When I found that, I felt, oh my God, that is heavy.
That's a bit like the Building 7 BBC fuck up, isn't it?
It is not easy to control everything, you know, and you have people who are not involved, like the graphic people at the TV station, they had no idea about this. I'm sure the reporter, he called the government, you know, his secretary, saying, please, I need a comment from the Prime Minister. And they say, okay, I'll connect you with Utøya, you know. And the reporter says, okay, great, great, great. Very stressed and so on, because it was happening. The whole thing was happening while they were talking. He speaks to the Prime Minister. He gives the graphic department, yeah, just it's direct from Utøya and so on. That's how it went down, I think. So I believe that on the island, you had Eskil Pedersen, because he was told, he said that somebody called him on the mobile. He was in the main building when that call came. He ran from there together with the captain down to the ferry. It's just 50, 60 yards. Jumped on the ferry, took off with some other people, his media advisor and so on. And they've given very different versions of what happened on the ship itself, or the vessel. They were in that building. I believe that the shooters were there. I believe Jens Stoltenberg was there. I believe that people from the MI6, the CIA, the Mossad, were in there preparing the whole thing.
So,
and then it was carried out. And these people were then brought out with helicopters out there.
So there's another sort of Operation Vortex situation.
No, Operation 40 was a team of assassins. Here we're talking more military people.
Okay.
I think totally, totally people taken from the Gladio network, skilled killers, and so on. So it is one massive mess, this whole thing.
Yes, definitely.
And also there's some Freemasons in the background, how unusual as well. Like the son, the dad of Anders Breivik, who's the fall guy, or whatever you want to call it. He is a high up 10th degree Freemason. And the Grandmaster of Norway, his name is Ivar Skar. He was in Oslo when the bomb exploded. And then he took his car and he drove more or less parallel with Anders Breivik, at least that is what he said, that Breivik went there. And he went to his summer cottage, which was right in front of the island, so that he was watching the whole shooting, the whole drama from his balcony.
That's a bit grim, isn't it?
Coincidence, it could be, but if not, it's very, very grim and sinister. And also, the war center of Norway, it's an underground type of bunker in a tunnel system inside a mountain. That one is located 8 kilometers from the island. I mean, that is just down the road. And I would very much suggest that that is a very possible area where this whole thing was directed from. Now we're talking not the Norwegian military, not the Norwegian police, not all of that. We're talking about NATO, CIA, Mossad, MI6, maybe. I don't know my MI6, but this smells like the CIA and Mossad. It's actually not CIA, it's DIA nowadays that do these operations. So,
well, there's also pictures of Brevin in full Masonic garb, isn't there?
Yeah, but these, if you notice all of the photos of him, it is somebody has erased the background very carefully, taken away the whole background thing. On all the photos of him in Freemasonry outfits, in the wetsuit with his weapons, all of it, it's so easy to put a different face like that. I've done it myself. I put the Dick Cheney's face on him. You know, it looks identical. I even put Dick Cheney with long hair, just to show how you can do with Photoshop nowadays.
Yeah.
So photos like this, do not trust them. Do not trust them. And also, these faces compared to the face of the photo on the police ID that he was wearing that day, and also the facial structure of the guy that was arrested on the island, it's not the same guy. It's not the same guy.
Does it look like him?
I'm telling you, they look like they could be cousins or something like that. Very, it's not.
What about clones?
No, I don't know, but I don't think so at all. I think we're just saying, here's a fall guy. He's the one taking the fall for it, and it's carried out by military skilled people. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody to be able to do a thing like this, you need to be very hard, you know, very, very raw.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people like Blackwater and Aegis about gun for hire is not big business nowadays, isn't it?
It is. It is contractors they're used like this. So, you know, I went to Utøya first. I went to Norway just before this happened, and I gave a speech in Oslo. It was very discreetly called Political Assassinations and False Flag Operations. One of the people in the audience, I was told afterwards, was from the PST, the Norwegian Security Police. So the day after, I went with a Norwegian, he's not even a real journalist, but he's doing incredible journalistic work, because no one else, I'm telling you, no one else is looking into this. I mean, this should be headlines globally, and no one dares touch it. I am one of three, as far as I know. Anyway, so the next day we decided, I asked, could you please first take me around the government building, show me the whole thing. So we went around there. I took loads of photos and different angles and all that. It's a so bizarre area in Oslo. The whole thing, the buildings are not being, they've not been repaired after 4 years. They're still standing there like a monument of death and destruction. It's very, very odd. But if you go down on Google Map, the images there are used from 2009, not the way it is now. Nothing has been repaired. They just started rebuilding some of that. That's after 4 years. Nobody really knows, as far as I know, where the government is working from. Very, very, very
So all the windows are still blown out. And...
Yeah, but they... On the 15-story high building, they put like printed plastic, big plastic sheets on the side, on the front and the back of it, with printed windows and window frames. It's just hanging down, and you know, like they're massive. We're talking, I don't know how many meters, but 15 stories high. That is like 30, 40, 50 meter high.
That's a big
plastic sheets with just printed windows on, but I don't know what's going on behind these things, but I would very much like to know what is happening while we're not being able to see it in these buildings, because they're just abandoned, and they are in the center of the center of the center of Oslo, where apartment prices, all of these things are, they are just sky high. So why hasn't it been rebuilt? Why, if they didn't want the government building there, turn it into apartments or anything like that? No.
Well, maybe if, like you suggested, that some sort of energy weapon had been, or the use of a technology that that dustifies, that if these still parts of the building that are disintegrating after, you know, this amount of time, that the they don't really want that on show.
It is a very good point. There was nothing dustified in Norway, as far as I could see, I've been able to see, but it has melted concrete.
I suppose the construction methods were different. So yeah, like you said, there's a lot of concrete going on rather than a lot of steel, which the towers were.
Yeah. Sonic, I do not know. It's just very odd, to say the least. Anyway, the day after, this journalist and I, with two friends, new friends I met in Oslo, we went north to the island, and we just wanted to get across to the island and get an impression, you know, and like I said before, an emotional connection with these victims, because it's so horrific, you know, to get a real drive to be able to continue year after year after year to face these horrors. I want to be on location, you know, to feel the pain, if I don't know if it makes sense, but to really because these people need the truth, need to expose what has been going on here. Anyway, so we went there, we went to the camping site, and we asked, this is the camping that is just north of this whole, where the ferry was, mm-hmm. And we asked if the ferry was, what was the timetable, and the woman in the reception acted a bit strange, I thought. She was not very open and or nice, and she said, well, I don't know if it's actually working today or something. So I said, okay, but then is it possible for us to rent a boat or a canoe? Because it said outside, there was a sign saying boat rental and canoe. She said, boat, no, because the man who's got the license is not here. Not sure with that, why that makes a difference, but okay. So I said, then a canoe. Can we rent two canoes so we can go to the island? And she looked very confused and said, yeah, but when? I said, now. Now would be a good time. Okay, so she very resistantly put out some forms. I started filling in. I put my name and these things. But while I was doing that, a friend of mine he went into the cafeteria, and there was another girl working there. So he asked her about the fair, and she said, yeah, for sure. It's just like normal. Is they're preparing for the anniversary tomorrow and so on. So when I heard that, I said, okay, great, let's go. And if the ferry leaves, we'll just take that. If not, we'll come back and we'll rent the canoe. So great. So we went there. And when we came down there to this small little parking, the ferry, this infamous ferry was there, but there was a cable in front of it, so it was not in use. And next to it, there was one of these, it looks like a beautiful flat wooden boat, you know, one of these touristic type of boats that goes down the Seine in Paris or in Amsterdam or, you know, that type
yeah.
of boat that I think are cruising along the fjords. It was there, and there were some people inside it. And then there were some people from the Red Cross sitting there. I mean, we're talking out in the middle of absolute nowhere. There are no people, there are no nothing. But there were quite a few vehicles that I thought looked very official. So I discreetly took photos of them all. Then we went to the Red Cross people that were just sitting there under what looked like a party tent. There was a similar one out on the island. We could see that. These two people were just sitting there. So we went across and asked, excuse me, but do you know when the ferry is leaving? And they answered very strange as well. They talked about when the last ferry was going to leave the island. But I mean, there was only one ferry. I didn't understand what they were saying. So they said, no, but it comes and goes. Okay, so we thought, we'll just wait here. So we were standing waiting. And then suddenly, after maybe 10, 15 minutes, three people jumped out of this tourist boat, this wooden tourist boat, jumped across the bridge and jumped into a rubber boat with a high-powered engine and just took off, you know, and just full speed towards the... They were in wetsuits with headsets and so on, took off towards the island. So I thought, absolutely great. So I filmed it to time, the time it takes if you really want to get to the island fast. Yeah. It took exactly 1 minute. Compare that to over 1 hour, okay? So it went over there and turned around, picked up some people, and came back full speed towards the mainland again. So we thought, like, maybe somebody had a heart attack or some kind of emergency. Out of the rubber boat came two people in police uniforms and came running more or less towards us. And I said, we're getting company. And the other ones thought I was kidding because they thought they were going to run and take a police car and take off, you know, because something had happened. But suddenly, boom, they were standing right in front of us. So they were polite and they said, hello, who are you? Please identify yourself. And we are here in Norway. It's not a police state. It's an open public area. Mm. So my friend Hans Gorder, the journalist, he said, but why do we have to identify ourselves? I mean, we're here waiting for the ferry, public space, why? And he said, the police officer said, listen, I'm not into games, just identify yourself. And my friend, he's really cool, really laid back guy. He said, but why? I mean, are we suspected for some terrorist activity or whatever? I mean, what is the whole point of this? So the police officer just more or less took him by the arm and he said, you and I over there. So he started walking off with him. And then the other police officer, who is a female police officer, he told her, you check their IDs. So my two Norwegian friends, I mean, they got quite scared because they were so intimidating, these officers. And the young woman who was with us, I mean, she had never experienced anything like this. She was like shaking for an hour afterwards. They showed their Norwegian ID. I had my passport in my pocket, but I just felt, I am not going to show you this. Not because it's a state secret that I'm in Norway. I mean, I just gave a lecture in Oslo, but since this is the first sign of a police state that ordinary people have to identify themselves at all time, I'm totally against it. So, but I had like a little Spanish insurance card with my name on, so I gave that instead. So she wrote down my name and everything and the other names. Then the police officer came back and he took the information and on his radio he started talking to someone. It took about a few minutes. Then he came back, stood right in front of me and said, "Ole Damegård, a decision has been made that you are not welcome in this area. You're not welcome here today or tomorrow. Danish police and Norwegian police has nothing on you, but you are, we know that you've given talks about political assassination and so on, and that you have theories that they are somehow connected. Everybody has the right of to have an opinion, but it's not welcome here. So please leave the area or you will be arrested." So
that's a bit which was crazy.
Well, anyway, this police officer looked very, he was very well built, you know, a military type looking guy, armed, which is, I think, very new for Norwegian police. And once again, it was, I think it was after this terror attack that, that they were, ordinary police officer were armed as well. And so my friend said, but listen, now when we told you who we are, who are you? And the police officer said, I'm not saying anything. And then my friend, he said, but do you mind if I take a photo of us? And he went up to sort of like take a selfie of him and the guy. And the guy just took a step back and said, you know, stop it, like that. The only thing I can say is, the only thing I can give you is my service number, he said. Delta 031. Delta 031. So suddenly, I was in a position where I was looking straight into the eyes of someone that might have been directly involved in the whole operation 4 years earlier, which also makes total sense when you want to protect a thing like that, that you use the same people. And later I've been able to identify him, and he was actually the second Delta member that jumped on land on the island that day. So, like I said before, I've been warned about going back there, and now I'm leaving on, I'm doing a tour on, it starts on the 18th of September here, next Friday. I'm going to the Open Mind Conference in Copenhagen, 2 days there. Then I'm going to give a public talk in Malmö, Gothenburg. I'm going to Stockholm to do a guided tour around the site of the murder site of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Then I'm going to go to Oslo. I'm going to do two talks exactly about this thing. And then I'm going to go to Berlin. I've been invited to a like a anti-human harassment conference in Berlin, where I've also been told that I might be arrested because I've done interviews about the Holocaust and the numbers not matching up at all. So it's going to be some interesting weeks ahead.
Yeah, it sounds like
I feel
a very interesting time. So, and can people find all those dates of where you're talking on your website?
Yeah, my website is Light on Conspiracies. That's Light on Conspiracies, because that is exactly what I'm trying to aim the light in the darkest of the dark corner. Totally nonviolent, with a heart full of compassion, forgiveness, at the same time, total fearless exposure of what's going on, because this has to stop. It really has to stop.
Definitely.
So,
we're coming up to
I just want to say, I just want to say that I'm not employed by anyone. I'm not part of a group. I'm not an activist. I'm just an ordinary guy trying to do my best to help us all. And if anyone wants to support me in that, I'm extremely grateful for financial help in the form of donations, or if you sign up for my newsletter, membership, buy my books. I've got several books. One of them, Coup d'etat in slow motion, which is about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, but with all the connections into the Iran-Contras, into even the JFK assassination, the sinking of Estonia, MS Estonia, and so on. So it's almost 1,000 pages, and very recently I've been able to get it up on Amazon, so you can find it there.
Excellent, excellent. And like I said before, we'll have to get you back on soon to talk to more, because you've you have got so much information.
I tell you, Sonic, anytime. What, and that goes for anyone, anywhere in the world. If I can make a difference anywhere, please make it possible financially to get me there and sort the whole thing out. Whatever it takes, I'm more than happy to do it.
Cool. And we'll play the tune that you asked for, Gary Moore, and Still Got the Blues.
Still got the blues. Sonic, before we do that, can I just finish with a prayer?
Okay, yeah.
It is a prayer. I'm not a religious person, but I'm a spiritual being. And it's my Raja Yoga teacher, Melanie Chelaram, that has this. And I really love it. It goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. Because we all need to heal. They need to heal as well. Otherwise, this will just continue forever and ever.
Excellent. Very good sentiment there. Right. You take care. And we'll speak to you soon, folks.
Take care.